The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. It's an absolutely gorgeous day in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I hope it's the same wherever you are. Let me run through the announcements, and then we'll jump into our program. And also congratulations to SpaceX for a great launch, and so far for a terrific job of troubleshooting and getting Dragon thrusters back online and the solar array deployed. I am following the Twitter feeds during the show, and if there are any significant news updates, I will let you know what they are. But so far, it appears that their troubleshooting is going to be successful, and hopefully they will be able to rendezvous with the space station and complete their mission. They're doing a great job over there, and our congratulations to them for a successful launch as well. As for not freaking out when there's a problem and going working the problem and hopefully getting it all resolved. And going back to, of course, the announcements for our program, if you would like to call us today, please use our toll-free number. It is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Do let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Remember, we do hold people over the breaks, if applicable, and we will also answer the phone if it rings during the breaks. If you do have call waiting, please disengage it before you give us a call on that toll-free line. And also, we don't do well with phone calls on VoIP, Skype, Google Voice, things like that. So if you call in and you're insisting on using one of those phones and your line suddenly goes dead, don't call back. It's just because we can't process the call and understand what you're talking about. And, you know, we appreciate your paying attention to these few things. You can also email us rather than calling us if you prefer. Our email address, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you are free to download our programs, and they're compressed MP3s, and you're welcome to share them and pass them around to people you think might be interested or should be interested in the program. 90 minutes is roughly a 40-megabyte show. I use transferbigfiles.com, but there are lots of programs where you can send that size of a file around the Internet for free. And if you have any questions about that, please do let me know, and I'll be happy to be as responsive as possible. We are trademarked and copyrighted, but we do let you download the shows and pass them around, as I was just saying. And also, please don't do anything commercial with the program. Don't edit them. No private YouTube channels or even edits or cuts for your own website. If you have any specific ideas or uses in mind, let me know, and let's see if we can work something out. And then also, we don't allow written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And we appreciate your following these simple guidelines. Do go to our website, which is thespaceshow.com. So we've got our detailed website newsletter there. It has all of the info and the guest bios for the week's program. It's the only place you'll find a future events section for what's coming up on the Space Show. And then if we have to change our programming for some reason, you're going to find those changes first on the website newsletter. From there, you can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning via email from California, or you can just send your request for that to Dr. Space at thespaceshow, .com. And everything we do is archived, so we go back to 2001. We're approaching 2,000 programs. They are all available for listening on our website or easily downloading off of our website. We have a store up near the top of our website. You'll see it called Space Show Gear. And probably the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. We are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we simply would not exist without your contributions and your support. And we certainly appreciate those of you who have and are continuing to support us, and those of you who will be supporting us. And if you have any questions about that, check us out at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do podcast, and you can find our podcast in iTunes, Microsoft Zoom, a host of other places on the Internet. The RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast is on our website and on our newsletters. And if you have any questions about that, do let me know. And remember, we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they do some really cool things with space, space policy, debris mitigation. You know, they're at the forefront of a lot of the main issues in space today, and you can visit them at their website, and we really appreciate our relationship with them. So if you have any questions about that as well, do let me hear from you. And that brings me to our guest today, and Mark Sundahl is back with us, and it's been several years, way too long, in fact. Mark is a space lawyer, but he's also the Associate Dean for Administration and Associate Professor of Law at Cleveland Marshall College of Law. He teaches international business transactions, commercial law, space law, and listen to this one, ancient Athenian law. I'll have to ask him what that is. Professor Sundahl is a leading expert on the outer space law. He focuses primarily on business, legal, and policy issues arising from the recent increases in private space activity. He just got back from the FAA meetings and a bunch of other meetings. His bio is up on the website, so you can read that at your convenience. But I would rather talk to him and find out what happened at the FAA meetings earlier in February. I think it was February 6th through 7th on commercial space, as well as some of the other conferences. And I really want to find out what Athenian law is. Mark, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you, David. It's good to be back on the show. Thank you for having me. I'm
so
doing well.
Did the Athenians have any space law, or what were they all about?
There were some ancient Greek philosophers that did speak about breaking through the fiery boundaries of the atmosphere into outer space, but that's about as far as it goes.
What is Athenian law? Can you just quickly summarize it?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I became a lawyer, I was actually a graduate student and earned my PhD in ancient Greek and Latin at Brown University and wrote a dissertation on ancient Athenian constitutional law. As with many other things, the Greeks developed democracy and a functioning legal system. And I spent a number of years trying to explore and disentangle the intricacies of that system before I became a lawyer and then a space lawyer. They still let me teach a course on ancient Greek law here from time to time.
Is it a popular course when you teach it?
It is. I think that the students, just like I always get full enrollment in space law, I always get full enrollment in ancient Athenian law. I think the students are hungry for something a little more esoteric and unusual.
You were at the FAA commercial space meetings, I guess that was about a month ago, February 6th and 7th. What came out of those meetings?
Well, they're very well-attended and vibrant meetings. This is the first one that I had been to. I was just appointed by the Secretary of Transportation to the COMSTAC, and so I went out to get more acquainted with the people involved at the FAA. And so it was the first meeting for me, but others that were there said that it was the best turnout so far. So you can tell we're really building some critical mass in the interest of people from the business, legal, governmental sectors. And there was a full agenda for 2 days, and we were visited by members of Congress, Dana Rohrabacher, Stephen Palazzo. We had Ray LaHood, the Secretary of Transportation, out there as well, and then a number of panels from commerce and law. And so there are a good number of things that were discussed. Probably the most exciting news was the discussion of ITAR reform, which if any of your listeners are familiar in the least with space law, they will probably have heard of ITAR, the International Traffic and Arms Regulations, and what a nightmare that's been for the commercial space industry since the late 90s. And I won't go into great detail, but just to give a quick overview, the ITAR is the set of export controls that restricts the export, the trade in munitions, in military hardware and military data. And in 1999, all commercial space technology was put under the rule of the ITAR, switched from the more lenient export control rules that are governed by the Export Administration Regulations under the Department of Commerce, which are much friendlier and less onerous. But after a launch accident by one of the launch vehicles built by Loral and Hughes Space Systems in China, which resulted in the sharing of technical information without the proper license, Congress reacted aggressively and moved all commercial space satellite systems under the rule of the ITAR. And ever since then, commercial space manufacturers and space companies have had to deal with this very onerous set of regulations that's put them at a competitive disadvantage with other manufacturers and launch service providers and satellite operators around the world. But finally, in 2012, Congress acted again to reverse itself and give the president authority to shift commercial satellite hardware and data back to the Department of Commerce. Now, President Obama has not yet acted on that authority, and so no actual change has yet taken place in the regulations, but at least now the president has that authority, and we fully expect that he will exercise that. So,
can he selective? I don't know the. Help me understand the law. Can the president selectively apply that authority? So, let's say Company A requests that this authority be exercised, and the president approves it, and then 6 months later, Company Y does it too, and the president says, no, I don't think I'm going to do it for this one for the following reasons. So can it be selectively applied, or is it universal?
It's going to be universal when it happens. The administration, the president, will review the current technology that's subject to the ITAR and decide whether all or some of it will be shifted to a Department of Commerce jurisdiction. Now, before this change in the law happened last year, the Department of State, which administers the ITAR, had the authority to grant exemptions from the ITAR and did in a few cases that are famous cases and are related to this. those cases were for Bigelow Aerospace, which had requested an exception for the passenger experience so that you didn't have to get a license every time you brought a foreign passenger onto a Bigelow space station. And Virgin Galactic also received an exception from the Department of State so that they would not have to get a license every time they flew a foreign national on one of their space planes.
I do have an update that came in, and apparently NASA has tweeted that they need three pods to get to the space station, and they're saying SpaceX has one pod needed. So has one pod working. So they're still working the problem, and it's still not totally clear what's what. But that's a very recent tweet from NASA's control center. So they're not there yet. So we're going to continue to watch it and hope it goes on. So when a company applies for an ITAR, do they go to the White House for that now, or do they go to the State Department? Has the process changed?
Yeah, well, not yet. I mean, as the regulations currently stand, commercial satellite technology and other commercial space technology is still subject to the ITAR, and so if they wanted an exception, they would have to apply to the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls in the Department of State. But we're hoping in the course of this year that the review process, space technology will be moved to the Department of Commerce, and then at that point, a license may still be needed in certain circumstances if space technology is transferred to certain states that are perhaps not our allies, for example, or for certain purposes. For example, if they're for military purposes rather than for civilian purposes, then a license may still be required, and that license would be issued by the Department of Commerce. But in many circumstances, if the space technology is used for civilian purposes, for communications, and it's being shipped to a state of ours who is an ally, a friendly state, then no, it could be that no license is required, although those details have yet to be worked out.
At the COMSTAC meetings, do they talk about human spaceflight? Did anything change with that? And also 2012 saw a whole group of new big-time commercial ventures talked about and claimed that they're being planned and financed to some degree, you know, Golden Spike and Planetary Resources, Deep Space Industries, et cetera. Did anything show up that impacts or influences these types of commercial ventures? Plus, there were CubeSat ventures that got crowdfunded, started. Skybox got nearly $100 million through venture capital in 2012. I mean, the landscape really has started to change.
It's extraordinary. It's such an exciting time to be involved in this industry. So regarding asteroid mining, not much discussion occurred with respect to that. There was at least one question, I remember, one comment from the audience. But I think more needs to be said regarding asteroid mining. There are some serious issues that those companies, I think, should begin at least to lay the groundwork to ensure that they don't run into legal complications down the road. They're early in their ventures, but it would be sad to see them invest billions of dollars, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, and then find out that they are unable to mine the asteroids because it violates the law banning the assertion of sovereignty over celestial bodies.
Okay,
that's an issue that has to be dealt with, I think, now.
I got to get a clarification because we hear from people that you can work the land like a federal lease, for example, for oil or natural gas on Earth. As long as you are actively working the lease, you can exploit the resources on that lease. You don't have to have sovereignty over the lease. So are you saying that somehow to mine an asteroid you would have to have sovereignty, which of course is not permitted with the UN treaty, or could you just work the land and hold your area of interest, or I guess the equivalent in space of a lease, like an oil lease, and as long as you're actively working that land, you can extract the minerals or whatever your business is for asteroid mining? Help us with a clarification.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of issues there. On the one hand, does a company, a U.S. company, for example, have the right to travel to a near-Earth asteroid, set up mining operations, mine natural resources, and then take those natural resources and leave the celestial body? I think that's one issue. And does that violate the ban of national sovereignty? I think that my view on that would be no, we're not asserting national sovereignty. We are just removing some natural resources, but we're not laying claim to the celestial body itself. But I think that there still needs to be some clarity on that point because there are other people that see that differently. And I think that companies would want that clarity. Another approach that the companies might take is to simply go ahead and do what they're going to do and dare the world to stop them. But I think that is the more risky posture to take. But another issue I think that is maybe of greater significance to these companies is imagine Golden Spike or Planetary Resources, any of these companies, spending hundreds of millions of dollars prospecting, sending out some initial spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, to prospect and determine what spot on a near-Earth asteroid there are valuable resources. And they determine that. They find a place. And then that news gets out. And one of their competitors that hasn't spent the hundreds of millions of dollars finds out where those resources are and sends a spacecraft there that has the capability to mine it. Now, the prospecting company, let's say it's Golden Spike, will not be very happy about that. And they will want to stake a claim. And they will want some governmental authority to exclude their competitor from that area that they've staken, where they've staken this claim. And is that possible? Is it possible for the United States to give one party the right to work part of an asteroid and exclude another? Or is that paramount to granting a private property right, which would rely on state sovereignty?
Well, you're really kind of, in a sense, talking about, in the olden days, claim jumping, right?
That's right.
Okay, and, you know, of course, claim jumping, you know, often who had the biggest and the most guns won the claim jumping contest. But what if it's a company other than an American company? So it wouldn't even probably be a U.S. court trying to figure out who has what, right?
Right. The U.S. court may have no personal jurisdiction over the Japanese company that may be trying to jump that claim.
So I think we all understand that there's a lot of, you know, vagueness here, and we'd like to see resolution. How does Planetary Resources or Golden Spike or Shackleton or any of these companies, how do they get this space property rights issue resolved? I mean, it's probably almost next to impossible to amend the treaties or get a new treaty. How do you fix the problem?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say their best line of defense is secrecy. Just, you know, guard that information as if it were gold or more valuable than gold. Don't let it slip out where you found these resources. That's the best line of defense when you're trying to protect IP.
And then you just go do it and say to the world, come stop me if you can?
Well, that would, you know, keeping it secret would solve the claim issue.
Uh-huh.
Claim and excluding others because no one would know where to go. But then there's still the other question about whether you're allowed to mine asteroids in the first place.
Okay, and how you still need a property rights resolution of some sort, right?
You do. You need some kind of natural resource exploitation arrangement agreement between the countries of the world, such as we have for deep sea drilling, and such as was attempted to be established in the Moon Agreement. But as you know, the Moon Agreement has failed, although maybe it will be resurrected. I don't have faith in that. But the Moon Agreement began to establish a framework for a natural resources exploitation regime, although it left a lot of the details to future discussions. But none of the major spacefaring countries in the world has ratified that agreement, which was drafted in 1979, and so it's really a dormant treaty at this point, a failed treaty.
Does pulling out of the OST help, say, an American company, you know, resolve this issue if the U.S. actually were to withdraw from the Outer Space Treaty? Is that a step forward, in your opinion?
To me, it wouldn't be a step forward to see countries withdrawing from the OST. I think that's been a successful and an important building block, a foundation of space law. So I hate to see that be the approach taken, and I don't even know if it would solve the approach, because it could well be that the ban on the assertion of national sovereignty is not only treaty law, but customary international law. Through the widespread state practice that countries in the world have recognized that is a fundamental international law, and it doesn't even need a treaty to exist, and that all countries are bound by it. And so withdrawing from the treaty may not even do the trick. It may still be subject.
So here's the 64, I'm going to call it the $64 billion question instead of 1,000, and I guess old-time listeners will know what I'm talking about because they probably remember that TV show. But you got a company that's going to spend millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, perfecting their business plan, going operational, actually doing some survey work and robotic research work to find out which asteroid might be, you know, have more wealth on it, you know, be a better target. Then maybe they have to design equipment and all this. And they're doing this with a lot of uncertainty because of the legal issues surrounding the ban on property rights. So, and in the meantime, they want to try to buy down the uncertainty as much as possible, like any typical business would do it. And yet I don't see a pathway, and I haven't heard you say one yet, of how they could go about buying down that risk. And surprisingly, during 2012, I did two or three shows. One was with an attorney, a space attorney. One was with one of these companies that wants to go and do one of these big, expensive ventures in space. And the other was just with more typical guests, but supported the idea. And they were all advocating and pushing for mandatory, let me repeat the word, mandatory benefit sharing. And they felt that it was the job of all of these companies to allocate some percentage of what they're doing to third world countries to bring them up into the modern world, as if that would work. I have my own ideas about that. But you know, when you talk to a lot of these companies, you know, benefit sharing is pretty much a dirty word, except for the few that I've talked to that actually believe in it. But you're right. There are lots and lots of parties out there that believe the Moon Treaty is still alive and well, that believe that companies should be required to benefit share and pay into some sort of a let's go help the third world pool through the UN or some other entity that maybe gets created. And all of this is in the uncertainty world of can you even, you know, do this and take the profits back, or are you going to have your claim jumped, so to speak, if the technology is available for you? Other people can probably get there, too. This is a hell of a way to be investing your money.
Yeah, I agree. And I would, when I say that there's uncertainty about the property rights issues, I'd say that there's pretty clear precedent that the profits of space companies do not have to be shared with equally among the nations of the Earth. I mean, you know, there are the provisions in the Outer Space Treaty and elsewhere in space law calling for the use of space for the mutual benefit of all mankind and for mutual assistance and cooperation. And so that language is rather vague, but if you look at the long history of the exploitation of space by private companies, primarily remote sensing, telecommunications, those companies are not sharing their profits equally among third world countries. There may be some benefits, for sure, that third world countries are gaining by having access, the ability to lease transponders on telecommunications satellites and therefore utilize space technology. And they are benefiting from the use of space in that respect. But I don't see any grounds for arguing that asteroid mining companies would have to share a portion of their riches with third world countries.
I'm getting a lot of emails from our mutual friend and my former grad student, John George, and so he says, this is one of his emails, speaking of treaties, what about the Cape Town Convention? The percentage of insured space vehicles, both launch vehicles and satellites, is really quite small, so do you think that the insurance sector for space vehicles and launch vehicles and satellites will probably start to grow significantly? So there's kind of two issues there. I don't think most of our listeners know about the Cape Town Convention. I think the only time I ever talked about it on the show was with John, as well as with yourself when you were on earlier. You want to do a brief 101 on the Cape Town Convention and take us forward with it?
Sure, I'd be glad to, and it's good to hear John George's name. The last time I saw John was in the conference suite at Milbank Tweed in downtown New York some years ago, where I had a meeting of the working group for the drafting of the Space Assets Protocol to the Cape Town Convention. And those of your listeners that haven't heard about it, it's the newest international space treaty. It was concluded just last year in March. This is the first international multilateral space treaty since the Moon Agreement in 1979. So this is something to be celebrated. It's also a unique space treaty in that it deals with private law, with commercial transactions, rather than the governing of governmental activities in space.
Is it a UN treaty?
And it's also different in that way. It's not a UN treaty, but it was drafted under the auspices of UNIDWA, which is an international organization that actually sprung into being under the League of Nations, a predecessor to the UN. And while the League of Nations went away, UNIDWA continued, and its task is to draft commercial law treaties, which it's done a good deal of, and this is the first space treaty that it's been involved in.
What does it tell us we have to do?
Well, what it does is it sets up a new international legal regime for the secured finance or asset-backed finance of aircraft, trains, and satellites. And in short, what it does is to facilitate the lending of money by banks who then take a security interest in satellites and other space assets, which then serve as the collateral for those loans. And it makes it easier for those lenders to then enforce that security interest, take possession or control of the satellite if it's in orbit, resell that satellite to another satellite operator, and thereby recoup the loan that it had originally issued to the borrower. And so it sets up a new legal regime to facilitate that, because that area of the law is a domestic area of the law. And if you have highly mobile assets that could cross multiple jurisdictions or involve the courts of multiple jurisdictions, which can be the case with space assets, then you're dealing with hyper-complexity and multiple domestic laws and uncertainty about which law will apply. And this cleans all of that up by creating a single international system. However, it's going to rely on the now individual states, countries to ratify the treaty, and only when it's broadly ratified will we see great benefits and harmonization from one country to another. And so we're now in that process of ratification. The treaty has been very successful. There was a separate protocol adopted for aircraft, and it's been very successful and widely used, but I can't say that that's not the same with respect to space assets. It's unclear whether it will become broadly ratified.
So let me play the amateur lawyer again and ask you for more clarification. So the registration treaty, says that the country of launching is going to be responsible for whatever, its citizens or companies or whatever put up there. So let's say ABC is an American satellite company and it goes into foreclosure and Bank of Japan takes back the satellite as collateral. And then they want to resell it, and Arabsat wants to buy the satellite for whatever reason. So can you transfer title, and is the United States still going to be perpetually liable and responsible because it was put up there by, American launch vehicle, an American company? Or once title gets transferred over to Arabsat, does whatever country of origin that has responsibility for Arabsat, does it take on all of those perpetual liabilities?
These do not sound like the questions of an amateur lawyer, David.
How many lawyers I get to talk to on the space show over the years. I've been trained against my better judgment.
No, I think it's definitely been sinking in. But, yeah, you raised two very interesting questions, and these are discussed in the working group and addressed in the Space Assets Protocol. Now, the first one is what if the Bank of Japan enforces its security interest and wants to sell the U.S. satellite to Arabsat? Will that go through? And this is an issue of, again, export controls. Do we want to share our technology with other nations and perhaps unfriendly nations? And the Space Assets Protocol says that the treaty only addresses the ability to sell the satellite, but it does not address export controls. So it will still be the authority of the U.S. government that will that can require an export license under the ITAR or under the Department of Commerce rules if those start to apply again. It can still require that license, and if that license isn't granted by the Department of State, then that transaction can't go through, and Arabsat will not get the satellite.
And then Bank of Tokyo can't exercise a claim to its assets to protect against the loss in their loan.
Right. They could try to take title itself through the treaty, but that would face the same challenge, but they might have a better chance of getting a license from the State Department.
So then, assuming the department and the people that work at Bank of Tokyo that know what they're doing with space, why in the world would they make a loan to an American company knowing that if they have to go after their interests for security reasons for making good on their loan, they could be thwarted because of our ITAR laws? It would seem to me the only financing that could possibly come out of this for an American company would be American banking financing.
Yeah, you're right on the money there. That's why we needed ITAR reform, and that's why hopefully we're getting it now. But you raised another issue, so what if we have an American company launch the satellite from the United States, and we have a Japanese bank that finances it, the U.S. company defaults, the Japanese company sells it to a German satellite operator, and the German satellite operator now takes control of the satellite, moves it to a different orbit. Now, is the United States still liable if that satellite deorbits somehow and falls on a building and causes a personal injury and property damage?
Well, you know they're going to get sued in whatever happens. You know they're going to be brought into it.
Yeah, everyone's going to be sued, of course. Any good lawyer is going to sue everyone and anyone. Under the liability convention, the launching state, which would be the United States here, is absolutely strictly liable for any damage caused on the surface of the Earth, regardless of fault or anything that they put into space. And so under the liability convention, the U.S. would still be liable and unquestionably liable. And that is a real disconnect because at the time these treaties were written, they didn't contemplate that satellites would be bought and sold among different private parties and different nations. And so this wasn't a concern. But now it puts the United States at a real disadvantage because they can be held liable even though they had no control over that satellite whatever and there's no fault involved. The U.S. is still on the hook.
So I would think that there would be a reluctance on other countries around the world to amend anything to take us off the hook because despite our horrific debt and economic problems, we're still seen as the deeper pockets of any other country around the world.
I've never heard it put that way before, but it might create a disincentive to change the treaty. Right, let us launch all the space assets and then trade them around the world, and if anything happens, the U.S. is responsible.
Yeah, the deep pockets are always going to be on the hook. We're not going to let you off.
Right, right. Now, if damage happens in orbit, then you have to prove fault. And if the U.S. U.S. company had no control over the satellite, then that would be very hard, if not impossible, to prove. And so the situation isn't as dire there. But if surface is done in the air or on the surface of the Earth, we're liable. We can continue to talk about liability. That was a hot issue at the International Astronautical Congress in Naples, Italy, in October, where the International Institute of Space Law held its annual colloquium. And liability was a hot topic, and not only in the space law colloquium, but I think broadly throughout the Congress, there was a sense that orbital debris reaching such a critical mass now that we are likely to start seeing the scenarios that everyone has been fearing for many years, more frequent collisions, and perhaps even, you know, getting towards that critical mass that could bring on the Kessler syndrome.
Well, let's talk about that, because it doesn't seem like anything happens, even, you know, when you have the collision. So the Iridium and the Russian satellite happened. Nothing's resolved there. The Chinese ASAT test from many years ago that put a lot of debris in the polar orbits. No country, as far as I know, has taken any action against China, and that one's pretty clear, you know, that China did it. So it seems to me that the treaties and the laws sort of require almost a diplomatic approach and solution, and once you get into that world, nothing happens.
No, you're right. It's extremely frustrating. I look at what China did, blowing up their satellite, creating vast clouds of debris that will render that orbit unusable for hundreds of years. The debris is going to stay there for hundreds of years.
And no consequences
and
so
no
far.
No one says it's illegal, that you can do that and face no consequences. Now, there are people that argue that if something comes of that debris, and if that debris actually destroys a satellite, that you could argue that there was liability for fault on the basis of fault. But, you know, will that actually happen? I wonder. It'll be very interesting to see. There are also people who argue that there's liability under more general principles of cross-border pollution, that you can draw an analogy to polluting the orbits with debris, and that there can be liability on that basis. I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see how this resolves itself, but it's frustrating not to see greater activity. Because we're all our destinies are tied together here. If we don't do something, I heard that if we don't do something, then we'll all be excluded from the use of space, and that would be a...
Well, you're mostly talking about low Earth orbit,
right
yeah. At the present time, right?
That's true. But that in and of itself would be serious enough. A lot of activity that takes place in low Earth orbit.
Do the Comstock meetings? Are they a meeting where they propose solutions? Do they propose regulations that then the FAA adopts? Or is it just a meeting of the minds to discuss issues?
It is becoming more and more, and actually an announcement was made at the meeting, that the Comstock is intending to take a more active role in helping the FAA develop regulations. And the Comstock was actually... from what I understand, a critical player in getting this ITAR reform, primarily through the efforts of Mike Gold, who's taken on the chairmanship of the Comstock, the vice president and general counsel of Bigelow. So the Comstock is becoming a very active body, but its role is to to advise the FAA on new regulations. And at this point, The Comstock is doing that, but also trying to develop a set of best practices, and not necessarily laws and regulations, but guidelines and best practices that companies will adhere to, even if they're not mandatory, to ensure safety in space, but I think also to mitigate orbital debris.
John sent in another question, wants to know if you're still personally working on the space protocol of the Cape Town Convention.
Well, now it has, the work is done. It's been drafted and adopted, and it's open for signature. There's still work to be done on developing the regulations for the registrar, because if you ever create a security interest in a satellite, you'll have to register it. I'm not involved in that process. I'm just actually putting the finishing touches on a book on the Cape Town Convention, and in particular its intersection with the existing law of outer space. I'm just finishing a book on that, and that will be coming out later this year by Brill Publishers in the Netherlands.
Let me know when it's out. I'd like to feature it on the program.
Okay, terrific. I appreciate that.
And do that. Do you see anything in space law as it is evolving today that might be troubling or a sore point for either the field of space tourism or these commercial ventures that we talked about earlier, other than the property rights issue, because we know that that's going to be a sore point. But what else is looming out there that companies and maybe the suborbital tourism company should be aware of or should be trying to work out resolutions to?
Well, a couple things come to mind. We had a speaker at the FAA conference from Spaceport Sweden, and other countries around the world are trying to develop, really catch up to the United States, and develop their own regulations to govern human spaceflight, suborbital and orbital, eventually, because the United States was ahead of the pack in that when it promulgated its regulations back in, it's been years now, so we have the human spaceflight regulations to govern the suborbital spaceflights. But now Sweden is talking about it, the EU is trying to develop their regulations and to decide what type of regulatory approach they're going to take, and that is a critical question. And it's critical not only for the European companies, but for U.S. companies that would like to engage in worldwide operations. And so it's important for U.S. companies to be engaged in that. And there's reason to be concerned because the Europeans appear to be taking a much more intrusive approach towards the regulation of suborbital human spaceflight. The approach that they seem to be moving towards is one of certification of the space vehicle, which the FAA does not do. The FAA does not certify Virgin Galactic's spaceship to. It simply provides some basic requirements that there be an atmosphere that supports human life, and that the crew obtain medical certificates that they're healthy. It requires very few requirements of that nature that would impact the design of the aircraft. And then it just requires the informed consent of all of the spaceflight participants so that they understand that they are undertaking a risk, again, that this spacecraft has not been certified by the U.S. government, and they sign off on that they've received that consent. That is a very laissez-faire approach to regulation that will maximize the ability of these companies to innovate without being forced to incorporate certain design features. There are people that feel differently about that it should be much more hands-on, that there should be more strict regulation of the design, but my perspective is that the government really can't be and shouldn't be in the business of telling these companies how to build their new spaceships. This is new technologies. We're trying to do something new and develop technologies that the government itself doesn't have. So I don't think the government is in a position to require certain design features. But the Europeans, I think, are taking a different approach, and that they may likely require certification of a space plane, and be more onerous in other ways. And so that would be unfortunate. It might prevent U.S. space companies from operating abroad from Spaceport Sweden, and the same may go for other countries. Will Virgin Galactic be able to operate from Dubai? I'm not aware of any spaceflight regulations.
They probably wouldn't have any. Yeah,
they might not have any at all. It might just be a decree from on high allowing them to operate.
What is the difference between getting a launch license in the U.S. with FAA and certification?
Well, certification, and this is beginning to getting to the edge of my expertise. It's getting into air law, but it's much more demanding requirements that have to be met, that there are certain standards that are expected by the government, that the components of a aircraft will meet, and that the airworthiness of an aircraft will meet. And if it doesn't meet those standards, then it doesn't fly. And setting those standards for this new generation of spacecraft would be difficult to do because there's really nothing to... There's no precedent for them.
Here's another email question from you from Alex, who's in San Diego, California. And he says, when I get on an airplane, I know that the airplane I'm on, even if it's a little Cessna, has met FAA standards for certification for that class of vehicle. And I have a level of assurance that the vehicle and its components have been tested and are safe, and I can rely on that certification. Maybe I'm making a mistake in relying on it, but people don't question the integrity of their aircraft when they get on them, even if it's just flying in a Cessna versus a larger commercial airplane. So what do you think will happen to the market for space tourism when potential customers understand that no such certification exists for space vehicle, no such assurance that any of the parts, components, or anything have been made safe and tested, other than the word of the company trying to sell you the flight ticket in the first place? It seems to me that as onerous as it might be, the way to assure a bigger and a more long-lasting market is to assure the public that you have a really safe vehicle and it meets objective standards. So possibly the certification standards would be different than, say, the parts that control aircraft. But if you really want to have a secure market and be able to build on it in the long term, being able to assure customers of this objectivity and the safety of what they're about to get into seems to be important. Any comments on that?
Yes, well, I think we probably will move into an era of certification of spacecraft, but we're in a very early phase of the development of these spacecraft. And so even if the government did say that they were going to certify these spacecraft, on what basis would they do it? The familiarity with these types of spacecraft just isn't there. And what is a reliable system and what isn't a reliable system? These are new technologies, and so I think it would be difficult for the government to certify them in the first place. But I think we will as these technologies develop and we do have standards and there is precedent, there is history, we'll begin to see exactly what design features are required and are safe and are reliable. And when we get into that era, I expect we will see certification that is probably very close to what we have for aircraft. In the meantime, I would say to the public that these space suborbital spaceflight companies are fully aware that the success of their venture depends on the safety of their services. And they know that if there is an anomaly or a crash, that may likely sink their industry and perhaps their company, maybe the entire industry. So I know it's not a perfect replacement for government certification, but I do believe that there's very strong self-regulation going on with all of these companies, and that safety is an absolute priority, and that there will be testing and testing and more testing, and only when they're comfortable that they have a safe vehicle will they fly it.
So the underlying assumption for that is that the company can objectively self-test, self-assure, and do a really good job. And I just know human nature and self-regulating, and as painful and as costly it is as it can be to have an objective professional third party looking over your shoulder with authority, that often produces a better result than the companies claiming they can do this on their own. And you can look at the automobile industry. I'm sure that Ford and GM, they don't want to cause accidents and kill people. And yet, what do? They design cars, for those that remember, with a Pinto gas tank that blows up on a rear-end collision. Firestone doesn't want to kill people with their tires. They design tires that blow up at high speed and cause enormous accidents and pain and suffering. And when they do the cost-benefit analysis, they look to see how much are we going to pay out in litigation versus what is it going to cost to retrofit, you know, the Ford Pinto or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, this goes on and on and on. My son has a 2007 Toyota RAV4, and he probably has gotten 20 safety recalls on the vehicle. And, you know, some of them they say urgent, critical, immediate safety action needed, and others are lower down on the priority list. But, you know, Toyota doesn't want to cause accidents for people. And, you know, a car, you know, the error, the problem, you may have time to recover from it. You know, it may not, you know, be a total catastrophe even if the brakes went out. You know, if you're a good driver, you have plenty of maneuvering room, you're on an interstate highway, you know, you might be able to coast to a stop and get off the road and all that. You got a problem in a space vehicle, the likelihood of recovering from that is zilch.
Right.
So I'm being the devil's advocate here, just, you know, to be a thorn in people's faces in every other place. But it's a different world.
You're not alone in having that perspective.
And so I am on the record, I don't want to see the early days of this industry regulated and certified, because I think it'll choke it. And I think once you start giving regulators a toehold in something, they are absolutely going to do what they do best, and that is regulate. I live in regulation heaven here in California, and if you go to regulations.gov, you can just see the regulators are in perpetual orgasmic pleasure with loading thousands and thousands of regulations on us. That supposedly we get 30 days or whatever to comment on, but you can't even follow it. And you can see how many are coming out every month and every week. So, you know, once you give them a toehold, you know, they're going to go whole hog wild and they'll come up with more regulations than you ever thought possible.
Right, right. And I don't want to, and I should say this, in no way I'm speaking, for the FAA or the U.S. government or its agencies. These are my own views. The FAA is certainly very concerned with safety. In fact, the FAA has done, I think, a great job of using its authority, to the greatest possible extent to ensure the safety of the spaceflight participants on these suborbital flights. Because, in fact, Congress only gave them the authority to issue regulations to protect the public on the ground. But the FAA has used that authority to still require certain safety mechanisms, for example, fire suppression systems and training of the spaceflight participants and crew in these fire suppression systems. They still use their authority to do that on board on the grounds that having that kind of safety in the air will protect the people on the ground, because if everyone passes out on board, that spacecraft is going to plummet to the ground and hurt innocent parties. So the FAA, I think, has used its authority to the extent that it can. And the COMSTAC is now one of the topics of discussion is what types of abort mechanisms should be used by these spaceflight companies, even if it's not required under the regulations. What type of best practices should be recognized to provide abort systems for the safety of those on board? And that's an ongoing discussion. So even if the regulations do not require certain safety mechanisms, the FAA and the COMSTAC are in discussions to try to develop best practices, even if those might not be as binding as regulations. Efforts are being made on those fronts.
We need to take our break. We're over the line, and so let's everybody stay put, and we'll come back in 3 minutes with our guest, Mark Sundvall, and you can call us rather than email us, assuming you can use a telephone. I know many of you are at work, and that's why you do email. And that toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Back, everybody, in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday morning Space Show. Our guest, Mark Sundahl, we're talking about various space legal issues, commercial space, space tourism issues, public policy treaties. Everything's up for fair game. If you're able to give us a call, it is 1-866-687-7223. And if you're listening at work and can't get to the phones, then it is, of course, by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So, Mark, I have a couple of questions sitting here. So this one is from Karen, and since she's referencing me, I'll throw it out there first. Karen says that she is in danger. Listen to me. She may be in danger, but she's in Denver, Colorado. And she says a couple of weeks ago, David talked about space tourism and non-liability laws in space tourism, and he used the Carnival Cruise Line Cruise from Hell, as he said, as an example. Apparently, Carnival Cruise Lines uses an 8-page informed consent, no liability section in whatever contract they have their passenger sign. It has provisions in it to stop class action lawsuits, among other things. Plus, as I understood, David, he said it had a Florida jurisdictional clause. However, there have already been multiple lawsuits filed against Carnival. That 8 pages also says if you have a grievance, you go to arbitration. But the lawsuits are being filed in federal court. I've also read on the Internet that the judges have wide discretion and can set aside those agreements that passengers signed with Carnival Cruise Line. They can also combine cases that are similar together, which I guess effectively makes them a class action lawsuit. And because they're being filed in federal court, they would override any state court issues or rules or laws. So I'm wondering if this is something to look forward to if there ever is an accident in space tourism, especially in one of the states that has passed these no liability laws like we just saw being fought out and finally agreed upon in the New Mexico legislature. Are these laws worthless? Are they going to hurt the marketing of to people of means? Will they not buy a ticket if they realize collecting, if there's an injury or death or something, might be really difficult, if next to impossible? What do you say about this? Is Carnival Cruise Line a good indicator of what may happen in space tourism?
Were you going to take the first crack at that, David?
Well, I already did on open lines. I said, you know, without being a lawyer, I think it would raise my eyebrows as both a spaceflight participant as well as one of these companies. And I can only assume, I've never seen the Carnival contract, but I can only assume they've had, you know, unbelievable lawyers making these contracts, you know, for years. So I don't think that you would find a contract that was poorly made. You know, I think they can afford to buy the best talent. The owner of Carnival Cruise Lines is reported to be a multi-billionaire. So I am assuming especially with all the problems Carnival has had over the years, that they know what they're doing legally to protect themselves as much as possible. But I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know if there's anything here that could be similar or could become precedent for space tourism accidents. Say something happens in New Mexico where they do have these no liability laws. You're the lawyer. You tell me. If I came to you and said my wife was killed and New Mexico's got this no suit unless we can prove gross negligence or whatever, can I bypass all this crap and still claim damages and have a leg to stand on?
It's a great question. Carnival is actually a pioneer in the field of choice of venue laws. I teach international business transactions here at Cleveland State, and that's the case that I teach every year, is the Carnival Cruise Line case of a couple that was from Seattle who received the terms of the ticket after they had purchased it, so they'd never even seen it, called a contract of adhesion. Right? There's no possibility to negotiate it. And it placed the venue, if they wanted to sue them, they had to sue them in Tampa. They could not sue them in Seattle. Tremendous inconvenience for anyone that wants to sue Carnival.
But they crossed
the
state.
And the court upheld it, and that is the law, that in commercial agreements, choice of venue provisions are going to be upheld.
Even in, so it would be federal court in Tampa?
It would be, it would be moved to Tampa, whether it be federal court or state court is another jurisdictional issue.
But, of course, moving it to Florida, unless you happen to live in Florida, is a huge inconvenience for people, you know, who live elsewhere.
Yeah, it would probably be in federal court since you had parties from two jurisdictions, from two different states, but the federal court would apply state law, Florida state law, assuming that was the law that was chosen in the contract.
Well, do the mandatory arbitration clauses and no liability, except for really gross negligence and all this, does the judge have discretion to set this stuff aside?
You know, they do. The waiver of liability clauses are by and large very difficult to uphold. To have someone sign a waiver of liability, especially if there's negligence or gross negligence. I mean, I think we all feel it in our gut that that's wrong, to have someone sign a slip of paper and then you can behave recklessly or negligently and get off scot-free. And so there, you know, those are not automatically upheld. If you have a specific statute, a state law that provides for the waiver of liability or elimination of liability upon the signed of an informed consent and waiver, then that becomes more difficult to challenge.
So
That's what we have in New Mexico and Virginia and other places.
So it's more difficult to challenge, but still can be challenged.
It could be challenged, but I think it's likely to be upheld.
So then, what is your opinion of the impact on marketing? So let's say there's 500 people that have signed up to fly on Virgin, but they have not been properly informed with informed consent, and I don't know what's in their contract, but I'm assuming they haven't been given all the details of the liability laws. I guess that would depend on what state they're actually going to take their ride in. So that is all to come, and I suspect that since these people are all with means, they're going to probably have their attorney look into this and review their contracts for them, and they'll probably have a business attorney. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a space or aviation attorney.
Right.
And they're going to sit down with their client and say, do you know that this is in there? And, you know, do you know that this is going to be really hard on your spouse or your children if you get killed? And on and on and on, and also you're a participant, not a passenger, as defined by law, so you could also be held liable along with the company for accidents to third-party people and third-party property. Is this going to say to people, screw this, I'm not going to do this, or their wives are going to say, hey, you do that, now I'm not going to be your wife anymore? To me, I understand why the companies want it, And I don't really even disagree with them. They're looking for a holiday to give them a chance to get on their feet and to become profitable and to grow and to sort of perfect their technology to a higher level. But in terms of the passenger or the participant, they're taking all the risk, and this is not like getting on a Southwest Airlines 737.
I would not be surprised if some people had that concern, but I just haven't heard it yet. What I hear, and maybe it's because what I hear is what is put out by the company promotional machines, but what I hear is people are lined up around the block to take these suborbital flights.
Yeah, but they haven't.
I don't think we've heard for those people that have decided it's not for them.
Well, they haven't been disclosed yet. So, I think
yeah,
what happened.
Yeah, interesting to, you know, if that's the case, that they haven't, had to sign these waivers yet and been made to understand the dangers that are inherent. Before they pay anything, they're required to disclose the dangers under the human spaceflight regulations, not necessarily sign the waiver that's required under state law. I don't have the language of that law in front of me. But I suspect that people that have put down their deposit have been made aware of the dangers and are willing to undertake this risk. Whether they renege once they find out that the state law could deprive them of the hopes of any recovery in the case of an accident and they decide not to do it, I'm just not sure. I haven't heard of that happening yet. Another option is to take out insurance. I don't know if that insurance is available, if any insurance company would take that bet.
Well, I think if it is, it'd be pretty costly in the early days of the flights, but then as the vehicles develop a good track record, that cost would come down.
Right. I remember you used to be able to buy insurance in airports before you got on an airplane.
Yeah, and people would do that, and then they'd bomb the airplane, right? I remember those machines that they took quarters, if I remember, in the 50s and the 60s. Boy, that's an indicator of how things have changed. Nothing takes a quarter anymore.
No.
Well, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the regulations and the actual informed consent for the vehicle in question play out, and I'm really anxious to see it. I really don't have a feel for it. I do think there will be some corporations that control key members of their boards and of their corporations, and there'll be some families who probably balk. Whether it's a significant piece of the market, your guess is as good as mine. I don't know. It may be trivial. And
yeah, it's hard to say. That's the we'll big see. Question is whether this is a sustainable business model to continue to do the tourism. Perhaps it will lead to other things such as point-to-point travel. It's hard to say how long that will happen. If you talk to Dennis Tito, we're going to all be on our way to Mars within the next
5 years,
10 years. Yeah.
Well,
on a more accelerated path.
Initially, a married couple, and you have to pass whatever their psychological profiling would be, and I don't know who could pass that to live in 600 cubic feet with someone else for 501 days.
Yeah, well, I hear there have been volunteers already.
Well, that doesn't mean they'll get through the psychological profiling.
Yeah.
I think that would be sheer hell, but then I'm probably too claustrophobic to even consider something like that. But I would certainly love to go to Mars. I'd really enjoy that trip. It's too bad it has to take so long at 501 days. If we had better propulsion, you could do it much quicker. It'd be a much easier trip. But do you think there's any chance that government regulations could be brought into existence that would prevent a private organization like Inspiration Mars from launching an extremely high-profile, very high-risk mission with two people on board that could easily go south? Do you think Congress might say we're not going to allow that?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about it much, but the FAA is looking now, the Comstock has been discussing what the next generation of regulations governing not suborbital human spaceflight, but orbital and perhaps even deep space, although no one's been discussing that I'm aware of, but orbital regulations of orbital human spaceflight, what will those requirements be, and would operation that Mr. Tito is planning comply with those, or would they even apply to what he's planning on doing? I don't know.
Why do we need orbital spaceflight human regulations? So, I guess here's my question. Do they, the fact that we need them is not ever debated. What is debated is, what are they going to look like? And I'm trying to take a step backwards and say, why not debate if you even need orbital human spaceflight regulations? But that's never part of the discussion, is it? It's just always assumed that there are going to be regulations there.
Yeah, there's a fundamental question there. Is should the law be out in front of activity, or should the law be reactive when issues arise? I think that's maybe what you're asking.
Well, yeah, you put it in a legal context.
And we know that there's going to be private human spaceflight in orbit in the coming years with SpaceX. Knocking on wood, their operations continue to go smoothly today and in the future, and then with the private space stations that Bigelow is constructing. So we know there are going to be humans in orbit. The FAA authority right now does not extend into orbit, so no governmental agency right now has any authority over human spaceflight in orbit. We do have the FCC, which governs orbital allocation of orbital slots and of the use of radio spectra, but we don't have any agency that has the ability to govern human spaceflight. And so why do we need that in the first place? I think that, we need the suborbital in order to protect at least the people on the ground from a flight anomaly, and then the people that are on board, I believe, also deserve protection. When you get into orbit, I think there's less concern about people on the ground, since for obvious reasons. But you could have regulations to protect the people that are in these space stations, that there be certain safety features, that there be fire suppression, that there be a dinghy in case it was necessary to...
A lifeboat, you mean?
A lifeboat, just as the space station has, that there be different safety features. Those could be part of the regulation. And there could also be regulations that, for example, prohibit the space station or spacecraft from getting too close to other satellites or other spacecraft. So these would be space traffic management regulations. And so I think there really is a need for those types of regulation.
So then the issue then really is, how do you control it and make it productive and constructive and not strangling?
Yes, that's the balance that they have to strike, and I my opinion is the FAA has struck that balance well, and if they get granted authority in orbit, it would be great to help them to do that again.
So how would they get granted the authority in orbit? Where does that authority come from legally? How is that established?
That would have to come through statute by Congress.
Signed into law by the President.
Exactly. Exactly right.
So Congress could pass a statute that a president could sign, and it could give Department of Homeland Security the authority to regulate orbital traffic if they wanted to.
It could. That to me would not make much sense, but
well,
I imagine that's not a bar.
No, I imagine. I'm just using it as an example, but you know,
yeah.
A lot of stuff. In government doesn't make sense, so I think probably anything could happen. What do you, if you were to look at 2013 as a pivotal year, what do you think are the biggest or most important or key issues in space law that can impact the emerging commercial space industry that we're hearing so much about, all the way from these planetary asteroid mining missions to going back to the moon for doing missions for lunar habitat and for even the Mars program, even though that's 5 years away. What's out there that you see as priority issues that either need resolution, and we know property rights needs resolution, or could possibly be a real detriment to the emerging industry?
Yeah, you know, there's so many issues, and you know, a lot of good things are happening. But the things that we've talked about, that we see ITAR reform come to a satisfactory completion, that we see orbital regulations that are reasonable and helpful, that we see coordination between the regulations in the United States and abroad, that we see best practices or debris mitigation regulations put into place so that we can begin to clean up that mess that we've created in orbit. Unfortunately, I see us moving in the opposite direction. You mentioned CubeSats. Now, CubeSats are not going to have the kind of propulsion systems that enable them to undertake evasive maneuvers and prevent and avoid collisions. I think that is another irresponsible use of space if you're not able to use space responsibly. But CubeSats, actually, in the number that they plan to launch, they concern me. And the Envisat satellite that the Europeans left in orbit, even though they knew that it was running out of fuel, that would have enabled the satellite to be deorbited, that, I think, is also irresponsible behavior and could present an opportunity to test the international law of liability in orbit if that satellite, which is about the size of a city bus, in polar orbit, actually does collide with an operating satellite. We'll have to see whether that happens. So orbital debris, I think, is a continuing issue that I hope will be addressed. So there are a number of things. One beneficial thing that happened recently was the extension of indemnification by Congress. And indemnification is that provision of the U.S. law which says that companies have to take out a certain amount of insurance if they launch something into space to cover any potential damage caused at launch. And if the damage caused is greater than the amount of that insurance, then the U.S. government will absorb the loss to a certain point, but will absorb the loss. And that, as you can imagine, gives great comfort to space companies. And that provision was expiring, and it has been extended again by Congress. And so that was a positive development.
Yeah, but they only renew it for 1 year, and our competitors in Europe, it's kind of a perpetual indemnification in Europe. So competitively, we seem to be behind the eight ball in this issue.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So that's a discussion, is what can we do in order to have Congress renew it and renew it for an extended period of time so that we're not constantly facing this possibility of losing indemnification. And one of the things that the Comstock is looking at is how to figure out how to undertake this calculation for maximum probable loss, which generates the amount of insurance that a company has to buy, how that calculation could be reformed, can be analyzed and restructured in a way that would satisfy Congress and enable Congress to extend the indemnification for a longer period of time. So the Comstock is looking at that, and the FAA will be looking at that in greater depth.
Are you picking up any greater interest, the same, less interest? I mean, you're not teaching only students that are wanting to do things in space. I guess I'm trying to find out how the interest in space law and space-related issues is faring over the recent years in terms of the general interest of your student base. Is space holding its own? Is it gaining interest? Is it declining interest?
There are signs that the interest is actually expanding. And I say that because there are new programs being developed, and I imagine they're being developed because the developers have sensed that there is demand out there. One new program that was just announced was the first air and space law master of laws, the first LLM program in air and space law, which will be at the Mississippi University of Mississippi. That was just announced. And that's in addition to the LLM that's in existence at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, in cyberspace and telecommunications law. And Nebraska is also, I understand, developing a JSD, a juridical sciences doctorate in space law. And so there are these new programs that are coming online, and so it seems that there's growing interest in the field. I know that, I continue to have students, and some of my students have gone on to pursue a master's in space law as well. So I'd like to say that interest is growing.
Are you seeing in the commercial side of your student work, are you seeing more interest in space commerce, in space careers? Are you able to ascertain any trends in that field?
Well, I'd say that the lion's share of the students that go into the aerospace field will end up counseling component manufacturers, because by sheer numbers, those companies there are many more of them than there are prime manufacturers, actual satellite manufacturers or launch service providers. And so most of my students that go into that field will be counseling those companies and dealing with issues such as export controls when those companies build components that are sold to satellite manufacturers around the world. And so I think that it's for those lower-level manufacturers where there's the greatest demand, but then there are also opportunities for the prime manufacturers, prime contractors, as well as in government and nonprofit organizations.
Here's another question, maybe the last one of the day. It is Ben in St. Louis. He says, David, I'm at work, so I can't use the phone. But please ask your guest, the United States is not the only country that has space law programs. I know Montreal has one, and I know there are also space law programs at famous universities throughout all of Europe and elsewhere. Is there a common ground in space law? Does a student who gets a master's in space law in the United States, I'm assuming it's all based on U.S. law. How applicable is that to space law if you studied it in England or Germany or one of the Northern European countries? What are the common grounds in space law programs, or is it apples and oranges, and the people, because of the differences in legal systems, don't really talk with each other but across each other?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Yes, space law is a multi-layered discipline, and so you have the international law, and then you have domestic laws, and then you have state laws as well, such as the liability waiver laws that we have in some of our states. And so there are multiple levels. The international laws are going to be the same wherever they're taught, whether they're taught in Cologne or in Leiden or in McGill or in Mississippi. But then you're right, the domestic laws, such as the FAA regulations for launch licenses, are going to apply to U.S. companies and not so much to European companies, and so wouldn't be as applicable there. But there's a good deal of overlap, and certainly a lot of the policies are the same, and as well as the technical issues that you have to be aware of. So there's some transferability there, and you can also, if you go and study law in Leiden or in McGill, I imagine there's the opportunity to learn about U.S. regulations, even if you're studying in a foreign country.
And the same if you're studying in the United States, you learn about international and foreign regulations as well?
I think it, to some extent it's possible, although I would also assume that you get a greater emphasis on U.S. regulations if you study in Mississippi or here at Cleveland State. I know I focus more on FAA, and ITAR in passing would address comparative European regulations, so perception.
When you go to international space law conferences, are there big gaps in meeting with your peers from Leiden or McGill, or can you all speak the same language? I don't mean do you all speak French or German. I mean speak the same space language.
No, I think we do all speak the same language, and we're aware of what's going on in each other's countries. And so it's very much of an international discipline and an international family of space lawyers.
Anything I should have asked you during our 90 minutes that I've forgotten or omitted that you want to be sure to let our listener and audience know about?
No, you know, I think we covered a phenomenal number of topics, so I can't think of anything we omitted at the moment.
Any closing comments, pearls of wisdom you'd like to leave with us?
Well, I think that we all need to continue to be supportive during this exciting time in the space industry. and do what we can in our different disciplines to support this joint effort. I think that the next 5 and 10 years are going to see extraordinary things happen. I, for one, am excited about it, and I hope to be able to come back to your show and just continue this conversation.
Well, let me know when your book is published, and we'll definitely come back and talk about it. And more of these issues, I doubt the industry is going to stay static, and so it's probably going to be evolving almost minute by minute, given all the new announcements, the new commercial efforts, the new financing. We didn't talk about crowdsource financing, but even that's playing a role with some of the smaller commercial projects in CubeSats as well as other things. And we'll have to see how all this shapes up and materializes into space operations. But a lot going on, very exciting times as well. Mark, thank you very much for being back on the Space Show, and I look forward to your return much, much sooner than the 4 or 5 years that it's been since you were on before. And wish you a great weekend, and thanks again for being with our guest today.
Likewise. It's a pleasure to be on the show, David.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for today. And our Sunday program is yet another space attorney. Wayne White is back with us. He has some interesting ideas on property rights through intellectual property. I think you'll find what he has to say of interest. I can't tell you that it's doable, but you'll probably find it very interesting. So that's it for today on Friday, and thank you all for joining and participating in today's Space Show program. Goodbye.